Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
And welcome to the Brandel Chambly podcast with Jaime Diaz. It's a great pleasure to be with Brandel again. Last Sunday, we saw the TaylorMade driving relief match, which broke the ice on, in many ways, you know, competitive professional sports on television. And it was liberating, it seemed, to watch it. Brandel, I wonder, and welcome, and wonder what your takeaways were from watching that and your thoughts as the week's gone on since then.
Well, it was, I thought, the overall day was terrific. You know, millions of dollars were raised for those on the front lines fighting COVID-19, and that was the goal. So I think they probably exceeded their goal in terms of donations. So it was clear that those that were sort of with pent-up demand to see any sporting activity, safely and responsibly get back on the screens, that was sort of met and exceeded. It was good to see the guys out there playing golf pretty much better than we do, but pretty much like all of us do, carrying our own bags. I mean, there was, I think if you were watching, it was kind of obvious to say typically a telecast shows the very best players hitting their best shots of the day. You know, with few exceptions. I mean, we'd follow Tiger around every shot. We follow Rory around every shot. But by and large, when you see a player pop up on your screen, it's because they're playing great and this is a great shot that they hit, kind of thing. But when you, when you put the microscope or the spotlight on four players and watch them play golf all day long, I think you realize they miss shots. You know, Dustin Johnson was clearly rusty. He had a number of balls in the water. If you're sitting at home, you're like, oh, they don't pure every shot. No, they don't. But beyond that, I thought, Matt Wolf was a lot of fun to watch. I knew his clubhead speed could get up around 130 miles an hour, but to see him get out there and hit it past Rory and hit it past Dustin was a lot of fun to watch for sure. But overall, it was a wonderful event. It was good to get back to work, again, in a safe and responsible way. I hadn't worked with Cara. Cara opened the broadcast. She closed the broadcast. I hadn't worked with Cara and I don't know. Maybe WGC Mexico was the last time I was in the building at Golf Channel. So it was good to get back to work and see all the people that I've been working with for many, many years. And all of us kept our, distance from each other. All of us had masks on. We had a great sort of team photo in the newsroom from very far away. And there were, maybe 20 of us working on the show, and we were all 10 feet away in a photo. So, that will go down as one of the more memorable and unique days in the time I've spent at the Golf Channel. But overall it was good. I think, those of us who are able to and can get back to work safe and responsibly, it's time, it's time to do it. And it was a wonderful day.
Yeah, I would concur. It felt like a turning point, not just in sports, a little bit in the culture. Something we've missed, and it filled a vacuum. I also thought Seminole was wonderful to see, especially the aerials, the scope of that place, the actual geographic location, and people getting a sense of that kind of golf in America, which especially in Florida is kind of rare, almost linksy. I thought one significant thing that might be taken away by Rory was the last shot he hit. And I know it was only a wedge shot and it was only 120 yards, but everything was riding on it. It was a very difficult shot with a lot of wind and a real tough pin position on a very slopey and super fast green. And he had to get it within about 15 feet to take home all the money. And I know that money wasn't prize money. It was going to charity, and it was a fun event. But I still think every time you're under the gun like that, especially as the number one player in the world, when all the scrutiny's on you and you're being judged, coming through is significant. And I think it's something he'll put in his memory bank. and I was happy to see him do it. Not that he would have been castigated if he hadn't done it, but every little bit helps, I think. And you never know internally what that means to a player down the line. Some shots are more important than others. And I just got this feeling that's going to be one that when we start playing again, he's going to refer back to. He knows. You go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say another thing about Rory that I really enjoyed was, you know, often when it doesn't happen that often that mics are on players, but when they are, you know, the world sort of has this really high expectation about, you know, something really funny they're going to say. And, you know, invariably kind of falls flat because they forget that, you know, these guys are golfers. They're not comedians or politicians. But, you know, Rory talking smack throughout the day was really funny. You know, him giving the needle to Matt Wolf, you know, two or three times. You know, one time they made him putt out from, I guess it was about 3 feet. He said something along the lines of, I think you guys forgot I won 2 FedEx Cups. And another time after Matt hit a colossal drive right before he hit the wedge shot, Rory said it'd be a shame to waste that drive. You know, and he was just sort of, you know, having some fun out there, which is, again, how all of us kind of play golf, you know. You're getting needle from the first hole to the last hole by everybody in the group. So it was really good to see these guys having fun with each other and sort of showing off.
I'd agree. It was a great moment. And we just had another great moment, of course, with the documentary Tiger Slam, where everybody's going to relive 2000 and 2001, when arguably the greatest golf was ever played. Probably the greatest golf of Tiger's career. We can debate that. So rich, I think, of a subject. And honestly, having watched Last Dance with Michael Jordan and him being the focus of that 10-part series, which really captured the whole country, I almost feel like I understood Tiger a little better through Jordan, through the prism of what Michael went through to be as good as he was and all the forces that shaped him. It was really, sort of a legacy continued through Michael, maybe through Kobe and on to Tiger. Those three guys seemed to be the ones that, you know, would just pay the ultimate price to win in good ways and bad ways sometimes. And I just wonder, just your overall thoughts about the accomplishment of the Tiger Slam and anything in the doc that really stood out to you. Randall, I know you studied Tiger so closely. Was that a crystallizing sort of condensed moment where, you know, some of the most interesting stuff really shone through?
Well, you know, when you were lucky now, you know, there's some distance between Tiger's high water mark and Michael Jordan's high water mark. And now that, you know, that sort of white hot flame of intensity has decreased a little bit. So they're allowing us to sort of get to know them, and they're sort of looking back and reflecting on it. I think the same could be said of Michael Jordan, but as it relates to Tiger, I mean, we are all seduced by Tiger's talent, but hopeless to describe it. You know, even Tiger, who could no more describe the origin of his talent than we, hated all attempts to do so. And he was determined to punish us for being unable to resist his genius, but now he seems to have forgiven us. You know, he will be more open to the questions, and he'll talk more reflectively about what it is that made him great. But it's still an enigma. I mean, there's the preternatural ability, right? The unbelievable ability, and then the extraordinary desire to get everything out of that ability. That's consistent with Michael Jordan and Tiger Woods. But it still doesn't quite get to the headwaters of everything Tiger accomplished. There has to be this that goes with it, this lack of complacency. You know, it's like never resting. You know, it's, you know, again, it goes back to people like Steve Jobs when you hear about, you know, how irascible he was. You know, there's just no complacency. There's, you know, with him, it was an actual intellectual genius and creativity. But this was all of that rolled into Tiger's talent. You know, and you know, take your pick. I mean, I think six USGA events in a row, four majors in a row, 89 rounds in a row where he beat the field average. You know, all of those things are what people do with that kind of talent, that kind of desire, and then a complete lack of complacency. They may be not that fun to be around, but it's breathtaking to watch, you know, and we, you know, we've said it a million times. I mean, he transformed the game. You know, everybody looked at him and thought, you know, what's that recipe? And best as they could, they tried to duplicate it. But it's a little like trying to duplicate, you know, Shakespeare's writing. You can read everything that he read before he wrote it, and you're just never going to write Hamlet. You know, I think the best you can do is say that you were privileged to be there, to watch it, to talk about it. You know, golf has given us greats, you know, right from the start. You know, there was old Tom and young Tom, Varden. Then there was Hagen and Jones. Then there was, you know, Hogan. And then Palmer, Nicklaus, Watson, Seve, Norman, and then Woods. But Woods had something that none of those others had. I mean, the closest I would think would be Jones. You know, Jones had every facet of the game, or seemingly had every facet of the game. And, you know, he was doing at 28 what Tiger was doing at 28. You know, but the game got to him. You know, it wore on his nerves, you know, and he retired at 28. He hung it up, you know, or maybe it was, you know, other things, you know, the balance of life that he had. But at any rate, he did have that balance, you know. People who do the things that Tiger did, you know, it's not usually accompanied by balance. You know,
the balance doesn't help. for that singular effort, you know,
to win by, you know, he won majors by, you know, 15, 12, 8, 5, you know, just he won golf tournaments by such wide margins that it, you know, how can one person be that much better than everybody else?
Hey, just a dumb sports writer question, but I guess endlessly debated. Where do you rank the Tiger Slam in history among the great feats? And I would start off probably with Byron Nelson's 11 straight, but maybe you have your own internal list or perhaps yeah. Tiger Slam above everybody.
Yeah, I don't rate Nelson's year. You know, if you look at, I would say the Mount Rushmore of accomplishments, and you could put Nelson's year in those four with Jones's 1930 and Hogan's 53 in the men's world, and then Tiger Slam. I would put Nelson's fourth of those four because he was playing against, as you well know, small fields that were weak and rusty. And because of a medical exemption, you know, Nelson's game wasn't rusty. He was able to play, and he played a lot trying to raise money for the war effort. So, I mean, it's certainly commendable, but he was as sharp as he'd ever been in the prime of his career. And again, I mean, I'm not demoting somebody's general here to corporal. I'm just saying of the four accomplishments in the game of golf, I would put it fourth. I just don't give it the weight of the others. And Jones's 1930, you know, it was an unbelievable accomplishment, quite clearly, but he beat amateurs in two of them, and easily. And then against the professionals, he only won by two shots in both of the majors that he won, the U.S. Open and the Open. So, again, in terms of dominating the world of golf, he wasn't as dominating as Hogan was in 53. And Hogan won those three majors by 6, 5, and 4. So an average of four shots separated him. Not only did Tiger win four majors in a row, he won them by an average of almost 9 shots.
Yeah.
So, you know, I just can't imagine anybody ever doing that again. Certainly not like that. I mean, like I said, the game does give us stars, but I don't know that they'll ever come along a star quite like Tiger Woods. So, you know, I was privileged to play with him just a bit. You know, I played with him in that transitional year, 1998, when he was still sort of changing his golf swing. I played with him a couple times, but obviously playing professional golf with him through that streak, you know, is certainly something I'll always look back on and remember. And then being able to cover him, you know, because I went into, you know, sort of the media world in 2003. And so I've, you know, been able to watch this, not as a competitor, but, you know, as, you know, somebody who's just trying to put it into perspective, which again, we all sort of fail miserably to do, because you just, there really are, you just can't get past finding him an enigma in so many different ways. You know, he was loath to let us in, you know, he was incessant and he was rigid and he was goal oriented, but talk was never his goal. You know, it was sort of a scorned obligation that he met. He didn't let us in, but what's great about this era now is that he's kind of letting us in, you know, and, you know, sort of, you know, as he's taken on this elder statesman role and he's talking to these younger players and he's a coach on, he's kind of letting us in a little bit. But again, you know, it's, he had it all, you know, you go back to his earliest days when he was working with a, sort of a, you know, he wasn't a sports psychologist, Jay Brunza. He was somebody who helped those who literally fight the toughest battles in the world think clearly, and sharing that knowledge with Tiger, who used it in an athletic world. And I think a lot of it allowed Tiger to control his breathing, and he learned to control his breathing at a very young age, so that he could be in that, you know, flow state, if you want to call it that, his entire career. You know, people get there, or most of his career, people get there periodically for a round or a week, but, you know, that was where he got his mail in flow state.
Yeah. Well, that's a lot to take in. I do rank, not 1945 necessarily, but the 11 straight, just the scope of that. I realize that the compromises of the war created less than a stellar week to week field, but Nelson was just so good to keep doing it. So I do rank that highly. I do think that Jones's 1930, because it was the focus of the world was on him. It was kind of a stated goal. It had to happen within a year. He carried all the pressure. It was during the golden age of sports. And it was the first time someone had done something like that. I think it was a little more epic than the Tiger Slam, but for sheer golf, you know, skill and virtuosity, I think Tiger Slam actually is the height of a year long effort. And Tiger, I really think the back-to-back Pebble and St. Andrews, those unquestionably the two greatest majors played consecutively. And, you know, some people believe that, and I saw it also, not every shot, but St. Andrews was almost more effortless than Pebble. He just did not miss any shots. It was really a clinic, that height. And then, you know, just as a note, Tiger winning the three junior amateurs in a row, which in and of itself is incredible, because when you're 15 and beating a 17-year-old or the best in the world at that age, you are really stepping up a few levels of progression there. It's really quite amazing how good he was at 15, obviously. And then to back it up with three straight U.S. amateurs. So in 6 years, six consecutive U.S. national titles. that itself, I don't think will ever be equaled either. In fact, that might be the most unreachable of all these. Who knows?
Right.
No, but no, in any event,
it's never going to be done again. Three yeah. years, juniors in a row, 3 years, amateurs in a row. Nobody's going to do that again.
I don't think so.
Nobody.
So he's just so off the charts. It's amazing. Brandel, you know, to get a little more granular, and you alluded to it, having played with him in 98, I think the way Butch and Tiger handled the transition, while it wasn't ideal from his golf swing in 97, starting right after the Masters and then, you know, building in, and you know the technical aspects better than anyone, these changes, was not something Butch thought should be done, in his opinion, all at once or abruptly. But Tiger wanted to take it on, whatever the sacrifice, and did not play particularly well in 98. And then it hit him in 99, and we can talk more about that. I remember some quick moments that really were, I think, just so revealing of where he was with his game once he got it. But what's your whole, you know, look back and maybe even in the moment while it was happening, how that transition occurred?
Well, if you do the math, right, or think about it, Tiger's had it. Rudy Duran as a coach, he had John Anselmo as a coach, he had Butch Harmon as a coach, he had Hank Haney, he had Sean Foley, he had Chris Como, and himself. That's seven coaches that he had. So, you know, clearly we're dealing with a guy who's a tinkerer, and he's, you know, he's always creating and destroying. And the golf swing that he played with, and I don't think this gets said enough, it was not Butch's golf swing that he played the greatest golf of all time with. It was his. You know, the golf swing that he came on tour with was of Butch's making, I'd say. You know, go look at Greg Norman's golf swing in the mid-90s.
Mm-hmm.
And it was almost identical to the one that Tiger Woods came on tour with.
Yeah, you know, shorter and rounder is what
he
did.
Well, it was a lot of flex in the right knee, really resisted lower body, big shoulder turn, short arm swing, club shut across the line. Now, Norman, you know, Norman played great, but Norman wasn't the iron player that he needed to be honest with you. You know, Norman won three Vardon trophies. And he averaged 64th in greens in regulation in those Vardon Trophy victories. You think about that. Now, Norman drove it great, but underrated scrambler and putter. Mm-hmm. You have to be if you're averaging 64th in greens in regulation when you win the Vardon Trophy. He won right. three of them. I mean, he led scoring average more than that. But so Tiger, after winning the Masters by 12, well known that he came into the Golf Channel, and sat down and watched the tape and took notes and came out of the Golf Channel. These were not Butch's ideas. They were Tiger's. He came out of the Golf Channel with a list of things he wanted to change, and Butch assisted him with it. So the golf swing that he won with in 2000 was his, not Butch's. His. He was teaching himself. Butch was helping him craft it. Very much like the golf swing that Tiger won the Masters with in 2019, albeit with a, you know, an older sort of banged up body. But the golf swing that he won Zozo with and the Masters with, that is as close to the golf swing he had in 2000. Well, Tiger is, you know, he's his own coach now. There's nobody there assisting him. Maybe Nota Begay is on the side. We don't really know about it, but you know, notice being a pair of eyes. And I would argue that that's what Butch was in 2000, because those were Tiger's ideas. And it was powerful. It was accurate. It was precise. And it allowed him to work the ball in every direction. You know, there's a strong move towards shut club face and strong grips. And you know, like Dustin Johnson or David Duvall, or you know, there's a strong preference for those in the world of teaching now. Mm-hmm. And I understand it. It is a great way to play the game. But if you look at the ones who've been the most fluent in this game, the grips haven't been as strong as a lot of them are being coached right now, and the face wasn't as shut. So you look at Tiger at the top at 2000, and you look where Bobby Jones was in 1930 and Ben Hogan was in 1953 and Jack Nicklaus was in 1972. And they're all very similar. They're very neutral positions at the top. And I think that's where you're best able to work the ball both directions, high, low. And Tiger had all that in 2000. He had it all. He drove. That's the best he ever drove the ball. He led total driving a couple of times. It was the most accurate. You know, it allowed him dominance, control, and consistency. Now, what the hell else are you looking for in golf than dominance, control, and consistency? The most amazing thing about all that is not that. The most amazing thing about all that is that he abandoned it.
Yeah.
He left it and sought to find something else. And he ultimately did find something else that allowed him to win as often as he was winning. Believe it or not, you know, from 99 to 2002, he played in 78 events. He won 27 times. That's a 34% win percentage.
Slightly higher from 2007 to 2009.
Yeah. But I mean, again, he came close to that under Hank Haney.
He actually surpassed it under Hank, is all I'm saying.
Was it 35% under Hank?
Yes, I'm just, but that ratio that you talked about earlier, what was it, 25? I wrote it down here, sorry. 25 out of whatever it was, it was just slightly higher.
Yeah, what I'm saying is that he was comparable under Hank, but I would argue that all things being equal, experience makes a player better, at least until there's a physiological decline. So I would say that Tiger should be better, and he should have a greater win percentage as until there starts to be a physiological decline. He didn't drive the ball as well under Hank Haney, and he didn't win by as wide a margins as often. But he was still, in terms of jaw-dropping win percentages, the player that he was, and the exact same scoring average under Hank Haney, 67.79 in 2007. That's what he had in 2000, you know, to the hundredth of a stroke. So Tiger was, you know, his career played out in almost operatic scenes of transition, where he was incorporating the ideas, the philosophies of one teacher, and bringing them to fruition. You know, and I have argued many times that his genius cost him his capacity for endurance. It cost him time, you know, all of those things. But nonetheless, it is, at least in my view, one of the more, if not the most mind-boggling thing in the history of sports. More so than winning four majors, more so than batting 400, more so than winning all the championships of Jordan, more so than anything Brady did. I mean, those things are all amazing. And they're the highest achievements in sport. But to think that all of those athletes that I just mentioned, Brady, Jordan, Ted Williams, imagine all of them in the absolute height of their talent, abandoning the form that got them there and trying to recreate anew something else, destroying the form that got them there and coming up with something else. And then once again, achieving a level of dominance with a completely different form. Imagine if Brady did that. Imagine if Jordan did that. Imagine if Ted Williams did that. Imagine if Babe Ruth did that. Right? They would never think of it. It would never happen. And not just once, but he did it. You know, you could say that he did it. You know, he had one game in 97. He had another in 2000. He had another in 2007. And those were, you know, you could say he did it three times. Sure, he ascended to number one in 2013 with another method. And so you could actually say he did it four times. He wasn't as dominant in 2013, didn't win a major. But think about all those athletes abandoning the form that got them to their level of dominance and consistency. Now that, when I say Tiger will never get beyond finding him enigma, that's where I'm coming from there.
Yeah, it's beautifully stated.
To do things I think, nobody had ever thought of.
Yeah. And, you know, that whole idea of, you know, creating and destroying, I mean, that's the classic artist. You know, he starts over. He doesn't live in the past. He's always looking at.
How about Michelangelo having finished David, right? Takes a sledgehammer to it. Okay. And then recreates the crumbled pieces.
You don't have to crush it. Just build another one.
Right. But imagine if he did.
No, I know. I got the metaphor.
And then recreated something just as magnificent out of the pieces.
Yeah.
Right. Imagine.
Well,
and that's, you know, in my view, that's what Tiger did.
You know, you have a very close eye, which, you know what it takes to make a swing change, and the littlest change to the untrained eye can be a dramatic one to the player doing it. So I'm going to, you know, defer to how dramatic that was. I think some of it's the nature of golf that everybody's changing a lot within themselves all the time. But having said that, the inside and shut at the top and across the line to outside and neutral at the top, that was a dramatic change for Tiger. I do just want to say, from 1999 to 2002, he won 27 of 78 official events.
Right.
2005 to 2009, 31 of 75. But your point's well taken that he should have been better with Hank because he had more craft, he had more experience. I do want to read something that Tiger said. It was a phone conversation in October of 2010, and he was looking back at 2000 and the whole change he had made with Hank and why he did it. And these were his reasons that he thought he actually became a better player. His counterargument was, in essence, the immense margin of victory occurred in large part because he had less game than he has now. So this is a quote. Those weeks at Pebble at St. Andrews, yeah, I got hot. The reason I was able to shoot those scores and win by large margin was because I played more aggressively. But the thing is, I had to. I didn't have as many ways of hitting the right shot. So sometimes I would force it against the percentages. If I was on, great. If I wasn't, I wouldn't really contend. I'm a much better iron player now than I was then. Also, I just didn't feel very good with the lag putting at the time. So I felt like I had to be more aggressive going at flags. Now that my lag putting is so much better, I know I can get it to the center of the green, basically two putt from anywhere. So this is where he went from, you know, the no limits approach to get the W. And it wasn't as, you know, poetic. It wasn't as dramatic.
I guess.
More effective in his mind. I'm just saying this is the perspective. People say, why did you leave Butch? Why did you change? And I thought this was as cogent an explanation as I've ever heard from it.
Well, I would argue that's why I don't talk to athletes, because because when they're talking, they're trying to justify. And if they've invested in something, think about it. If you buy a car, you buy a car that not necessarily made sense, you're going to defend it. You buy something, you invest in something, you're going to defend it. At all costs, you're going to defend it. But nothing he just said made any sense at all. I would disagree with all of it, and I would flatly say it was wrong. He had 110 rounds in a row, he played 110 holes in a row without making a bogey in that period in 2000. He had 89 rounds in a row where he beat the field average. Lowest scoring average in the history of the game, widest margin, most consistent golf, highest birdie percentage. So by any measure, he was better at every – they didn't have the strokes gain approach metric to use in 2000. But his greens and regulation average, which was the metric that they used then, exceeded anything that he accomplished from 2004 to 2009. So, you know, of course he's going to defend it because it makes no sense leaving Butch. None whatsoever. Now, we don't know. None of us know what transpired between Butch and Tiger, to what extent, but from a technical standpoint, from a competitive standpoint, from any metric you want to use that makes any sense at all, he was he wasn't a lesser player. It was, you know, I would argue, and of course, you know, I could be way off, I could be wrong, but I would argue he was just merely defending the decision to leave a coach that while he was with him, he played the greatest golf that's ever been played. As good as he played under Hank in that period of 2004-2009, from a win percentage, yes, but from every other percentage in terms of scoring and you know, his differential from where he was and the field was that he was competing against, it was the greatest golf ever played. His golf under Hank wasn't as good in that regard. Now, that's not disparaging Hank. Certainly, right. Hank brought to him some elements. I think Hank focused more on wedge play and lag putting and not making mistakes and playing conservative golf and all of those things. You know, I appreciate and can respect somebody defending their decision, but the numbers say otherwise.
I guess his view would be his hot golf, when he got hot, was better in 2000, 2001 than it ever was after, because he was trying for more difficult, more, you know, aggressive shots. And he started playing, in his mind, the percentages wasn't as impressive shot for shot, but the totals ended up as good or a little better in his mind. So I you know, it's a great study, and I respect your saying, and I think it's true. Every athlete, they don't want to regret. They don't want to think they made a mistake.
No, of course not. They're going to defend it.
Yeah, I get that. But I also think Tiger is a good analyst of himself, better than most on his sport when it comes to breaking down why he was good and what he lacked. He was always humble, I thought, about his weaknesses. He was always very candid about it, admitting them and saying what he wanted to tackle.
Oh, he was that. Yeah, you're right. He was humble. I'll give you that. He really was. About golf, which is amazing.
So I thought he was pursuing something honestly, whether he got there or not. I mean, that's the thing about the Tiger Slam. It's such an incredibly high achievement that even if he got better, it would be hard to surpass it. So, your point's taken. And I think that was really well said about, you know, your view that let's not forget just how very, very good that was.
When you're down, it's like when I said I don't talk to athletes. It's like I don't base my entire opinion upon what an athlete says. I know when they're talking, and I've said it, the minute an athlete shows up at a golf tournament, a golfer shows up, right? Everything they do and say is to help them play better.
Right.
So if they're walking fast, they think they need to. If they're walking slow, they think they need to. If they're eating at this restaurant or eating this food or sleeping at this time, and what they're saying in the media center has, if they're to use your word, coaching at all, is strategic. They're either trying to psychologically get themselves in the right, to create the right frame of reference or the right mental approach, or they're trying to put things out there for the media in such a way that they won't have to answer to them later. So it's a way of sort of protecting their environment, their psyche. So when I'm listening to them, and I always look up what they say. Is it true? Is it not? And I get it. I'm not holding them. Look, if it's not true, I understand the need to forget, you know, selectively and be optimistic. I understand that. But from an analytical standpoint, I'm trying to get to the headwaters of whatever's going on.
Right, to the essence of it. I get it. And, yeah. You know, honestly, Randall, I mean, so was I. I not with as sophisticated an eye as you have, but at the same time, I listen to a lot of things, you know, that the players say, that Tiger said over the years. And a lot of times it was self-protective or it was deflective. I thought this particular thing was on point as far as what he genuinely believed. I didn't find it as much of a rationalization as you did. But, you know, I guess the numbers speak for themselves, and Tiger Slam speaks for itself. So, and one thing that the intangible in all this too is one of the bigger intangibles is the putter. And I mean, he putted during the Tiger Slam in particular, just so flawlessly. And I wonder if we could switch to that topic and just what you saw in his putting stroke at that moment. I mean, a lot of that, of course, is about frame of mind and the sense of serenity that comes from all that confidence that he had. But is it arguable that he never putted better than that? And, you know, apart from the golf swing, the putter was the, you know, the decider, so to speak, in terms of his dominance.
Well, I'll give Butch full credit here. He encouraged him to reach out to Ben Crenshaw and talk to Ben about putting. Mm-hmm. And it's up in the air as to where that conversation took place. Butch says it's one place, Tiger says it's another, but Ben Crenshaw says it's another, and it's reported in the newspaper as another. But I believe reading through all of that, that it happened at the Byron Nelson in 1999. And it's almost as if a switch was flipped.
Yeah.
A before and after, because Tiger was, I believe, 68th and 147th his first 2 years in putting average on the PGA Tour. So you're not going to call that great. But that changed in 99. It certainly changed in 2000. It changed on the weekend after he talked to Ben at the Byron Nelson. And, you know, Ben essentially shared with him the ideas that Bobby Jones used in his putting stroke, you know, almost 80 years before or whatever, 70 years before. And it was, you know, to grip the putter lighter. And to allow the, you know, which obviously allows the putter head to flow more and to get behind your hands more and to have more release. And I think, you know, that allows the putter to feel heavy, you know, feeling the weight, you know, allows the putter head to flow. You know, most people grip it too tightly and the putter doesn't feel heavy. And, you know, all of these things are cumulative, because I think the putter feeling heavy in his hands, having more flow, allows you to hit it more solid. And when you hit it more solid, I believe it helps you read greens better. You know, I don't think it's a coincidence that, you know, everybody that had a gift, it was always called a gift or a, you know, great putting ability, they say, well, they're great green readers. I think the two are married together, because if you hit consistently solid putts, then you begin to trust your reads more.
Mm-hmm.
And you begin also to worry less about the mechanics of your stroke. And as you do so, you then can assimilate more information. You can take on more nuance. You won't miss the grain of a green or a little slope or your body chemistry and how it matches up to the situation and the green and the grain. And all of those things make you a great green reader, make you hit it on the right line with the right speed. And that those are, they all go together, you know? And I think the genesis of that happened, I would argue, in Irving, Texas, at the Byron Nelson. And that's the headwaters, at least the way I look at it, for his great putting. That basically carried him through, you know, the rest of his career. When you see Tiger Woods putting with his right hand, that's, you know, that's a drill that goes all the way back to, you know, the earliest days of golf in this country with the greatest putters. Horton Smith, Walter Travis, Bobby Jones, Bobby Locke. You know, it's a right-handed release. And to do that, you have to have, you know, a little bit of, you know, slight grip pressure. And you got to let the putter get behind your hands. So you put all that together. And so there Tiger Woods is, He was the best driver of the golf ball then. He was the best iron player. And he was the best putter.
Yeah.
And he was better under pressure. And you couldn't say that about his game from 2004 to 2009. You couldn't say that because he wasn't the best driver, not by a long shot. So when you put all those things together in 2000, it's like there's supposed to be some rub in this game. If you hit it long, you're supposed to hit it kind of in you know, and if you always hit more greens, then your chipping is not going to be great. And if, you know, you always hit it 20 feet, well, you're going to miss a lot of those. So you're not going to be as optimistic and you, it's not going to look like you're a great putter and you're not going to act like you're a great putter. There's always rub. There always was with every single player. And again, save Bobby Jones, there was always some rub. There was always some give and take in the game. And that wasn't the case with Tiger. He had every facet of the game to its highest extent.
And he was the one guy that for a brief moment had everything.
It wasn't that brief, though, was it?
It wasn't that brief.
Yeah. About a 5-year period where he had it all. And then, you know, even as it sort of regressed, he still had the experience. And, his iron play was – and look, I'll agree, his iron play – was, you know, I don't know if it was ever 2000 good. I'd love to see strokes gained approach on his iron play in 2000. Too bad we don't have it. But, his iron play was, you know, at periods in that 2004, 2009, it was probably close to what it was in 2000. But he was never as good a driver as he was in 99, yeah. 2000, 2001.
Yeah, Butch talked about the statement in the documentary on the second hole at Pebble, which was a beast in those days, especially, and very tough driving hole, required a driver, and Tiger piped it four times. And it was significant, not only to Tiger, but to his playing partners, that there's something extra here with the driver. But, you know.
Yeah, I've used that swing many times over the years. You can find it on YouTube, our audience listening.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can go to YouTube and find that swing he makes off 2T on Sunday playing with Ernie Els. And it's worth, you know, the swing he made there on Sunday and the swing he made off of 6T on Sunday are, you know, they're equivalent to the Hogan swings at Carnoustie in 53. They're just as good as a golf swing ever was made.
Right. And I think you're on to something absolutely with the Crenshaw influence. And I say this, and I say it with all modesty. I hope nobody thinks I'm in any way putting myself in Tiger's mind as a golfer. But I was fortunate to play with him a couple of times when he was in his teens still. And, I mean, I'm not that good a player, but not a bad putter. And it wasn't that he was asking advice. He just wanted – I think he had been sort of polling people that he played with. How tight do you grip it? And I told him I gripped it pretty loose and kind of showed him – why, you know, how the putter kind of moved. And he goes, I grip it tight, man. But I could tell he was sort of, not that he was going to switch because of me, but it was something that was in his head about maybe, because he knew Watson did, gripped it tight. And I think he liked Watson's stroke and that was an influence. But I think it took someone of the stature and credibility of Crenshaw to flip him. And maybe he was very close to flipping already. But as soon as he started putting lightly like that, absolutely, he became a better putter with more flow. And, you know, he found something on Wednesday night, as we know from the documentary, at Pebble. He spent a couple hours on the putting green there into the twilight with the little lights of the shops going on. And it was about the release. And, you know, he didn't like the way the ball was rolling. It was kind of skidding in his mind. And he always liked it to kind of feel like a little mini hook. And that was from the right hand, flowing freely and with a nice light grip. And he changed his posture a little, gave himself a little more room for his arms to swing, and it clicked. And I mean, he hit one bad putt, I think you could trace it in that whole championship. And it was the 10 footer for a double bogey on 3 on Saturday. He made triple and he walked away smiling because that's where his mind was at that time. He wasn't really angry. He almost was philosophical about it. Even I can't be perfect. But after that, he craned everything. And as you know, Pebble is got the hardest 10 footers in the world because of the amount of break. So I think you're really onto something with the Crenshaw breakthrough. I thought we'd move on, unless you wanted to say something more about the putter.
No. I think you've covered it. It wasn't Crenshaw. It was Jaime Diaz that convinced him.
Oh yeah, right. See, yeah, I was afraid of that.
I'll have to edit the book I'm writing.
Okay. Well, if I make your book, that'll be the height of my career. But thanks. Now, one other thing, and you pointed this out, was the golf ball and the change that he made in May of 2000, when Nike had come out with the Nike Tour Accuracy. Tiger had been testing with it. It was a multi-layer solid core ball, as the Pro V1 was, as Precept had come out with a ball as well, Bridgestone, and the
Pro Spalding. V1 came out later, though.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And the Spalding Strata. Tiger at that time was playing a Titleist Professional that was a wound ball. So this was the new technology, and he knew that it was better, but he was going to wait till after the season and fully test it. But something told him, I want to switch this ball now, and actually had the Nike guys come out to Germany where he's playing in a tournament, and so he could test it further. And then he put it in play right away and won immediately at the Memorial by 6 strokes, and then went to Pebble. So you went through this transition yourself as a player, from one ball to the other, and one technology to the other. Tell me your reflections on what it meant to Tiger and what it was like in terms of the difference in the ball.
Well, you know, it is important to note that, you know, a ball switch to a solid core, you know, multi-layered solid core golf ball. You know, it had happened in the early 90s with Nick Price. And Nick went from, you know, being a sort of average driving distance to certainly not number one in the world and picking up 12, 15 yards. And if you pick up 12, 15 yards and all things stay the same, you're going to pick up the better part of a stroke in scoring average, which he did. And he went from being, you know, 30th in the world to first in the world. And nobody really paid attention to the ball switch being a big factor in that. And then Mark O'Meara in 1998 switched again to a solid core construction, multi-layered golf ball and won 2 major championships. You know, picked up yardages and won 2 major championships. And still nobody paid much attention to it except for Tiger. Tiger did. And then, you know, Tiger started this process. And when he did switch to that solid core, you think about that. You're the only one on the field, basically, save one or two other players, but you have a ball that's made just for you that gives you an advantage in flight, in distance, everything. So not only was he, you know, the superior athlete with superior talent, and superior skill and all that, he had superior equipment that nobody else had. I mean, he was the earliest of adopters. Okay. Nobody really paid attention to Nick. You know, Nick didn't have Tiger's talent, who did. O'Meara didn't have Tiger's talent, who did. But you put that equipment, that technology in Tiger's hands, and he blew the field away. And everybody noticed. And you had players all of a sudden saying, because look, a lot of the reason why they didn't switch is because most players were locked up in ball contracts with Titleist. And so now then everybody is saying to Titleist, we need a solid core multi-layer construction golf ball. And by the end of 2000, they had one. And Billy Andrade won with it at Las Vegas. So if you dig into the minutiae of the game, I mean, Tiger transformed this game in many, many ways. But less well known is how he transformed the game in technology. I mean, the Pro V1 may well have been, you know, underway, but Tiger certainly hastened its arrival. And the game, by 2002, almost everybody was playing a, I'm sorry, by 2001, almost everybody was playing a solid core golf ball. And everybody was by 2002, 2003. So, you know, a lot happened that week at Pebble Beach. I can remember being on tour then and them bringing that ball out as a testing ball sort of at the end of 2000. And, you know, it felt like a rock to me, but, you know, they didn't have the equivalent of, you know, this forensic, you know, they didn't have TrackMan available to get trajectories, fly numbers, spin rates, you know, but what Tiger had done was, you know, he had access to, you know, better ways to test, and he did. And he did all the math, and he knew for sure it was a better ball. So the earliest of adopters, and with all that talent, and that certainly played into those blowout victories, no question.
Yeah, I think certainly the physics of it, I'm sure, as you say, better ball flight, penetrating in the wind, your errors minimized perhaps just a little bit. But I think psychologically, for someone of that ability to have an extra edge kind of at the last minute like that, incredible exponential confidence builder, I would imagine. I know when he had laser surgery, he came back and won right away. He thought, oh, I can see better. And it gave him this extra boost. And all you have to give someone of that kind of genius is another little edge. And I think the distance between them and other players in their mind grows way greater. So that was an unsung part of this. So much in the Tiger Slam, so rich. What a prism to look through at his whole career and his whole personality. And it does come through through Butch Harmon and through Steve Williams, who I think were great in the documentary. Did you feel like you learned anything that you didn't know in that documentary?
I mean, you know, little personal anecdotes here or there, but, you know, I mean, no, I enjoyed it. You know, it was a nostalgic look back at the greatest golf that's ever been played. You know, I would love to have, you know, something similar on Hogan's 53 and Jones's 1930 and Nelson's 1945. I mean, I wish, you know, we had their coaches, Stuart Maidens and the Henry Picards with Hogan and, you know, whoever. I mean, it'd be nice. I mean, I think this is a marvelous piece of history that, you know, 100 years from now, they'll still be trying to figure out what made Tiger such an incredible athlete. And they'll have this documentary to sort of, you know, peel the onion back a little bit.
Yeah, and coming on the heels of The Last Dance, I think it just is going to, I think, incentivize athletes, great athletes, to have these kind of records. You know, Kobe was having a lot of filming of his last year, and I think LeBron will do this now, and maybe Brady. And I think we're probably opening the way to a whole era of really classic sports documentaries. So thank you, Brandel. Always great to hear.
Thank you,
all your
Jaime.
Reflections.
Really, yeah. Really enjoyed talking to you, Jaime.
As always, thanks, Brandel, and thank you, audience. Once again, hope you enjoyed Tiger Slam, the documentary, and our discussion, and look forward to the next time. Thank you.
Bring on spring projects with Spring Black Friday Savings from The Home Depot. With free delivery on over 2 million items, you can bring on the spring cleaning, the patio decorating, and the front yard gardening. And if you need it fast, get same-day delivery on thousands of products like fertilizer and seeds to keep your yard looking beautiful. Bring on the spring doing and spring your way only at The Home Depot. How doers get more done. Order select in-stock items by 4 p.m. subject to availability.